Hey, everybody. Welcome. Well, have we got a tale for you today? I'm going to give you a clue. And by give you a clue, I guess I mean I will just tell you exactly what it is. Today we're talking about a man named Elmer McCurdy. Who is Elmer McCurdy, you may wonder? Well, wonder no more, because I will tell you. Born January 1st, 1880, died October 7th, 1911. I feel like I need to skip down, so we'll start with his background. He was born in Washington, Maine. That's not confusing. On January 1st, 1880, hey, New Year's baby. He was the son of 17-year-old Sadie McCurdy, who was an unmarried at the time of his birth. The identity of McCurdy's father is unknown. One possibility is Sadie's cousin. Well, that's nice. We got this dead guy. Spoiler alert, he's dead. But he was born in 1880, so. Yeah, it's like, hey, his dad could have been his cousin. In order to save Sadie from the embarrassment and shame of raising an illegitimate child, her brother George and wife Helen adopted Elmer. And also they named him Elmer, which why? After George died of tuberculosis, Jesus, in 1890, Sadie and Helen moved with Elmer to Bangor, Maine. Sadie eventually told her son that she, not Helen, was his mother, and that she was unsure of who his biological father was. The news disturbed McCurdy, who grew resentful and became unruly and rebellious. As a teenager, he began drinking heavily, a habit he would continue through his life. He eventually returned to Maine to live with his grandfather and became an apprentice plumber. Oh, see, he's turning it around. He reportedly was a competent worker and lived comfortably until the economic downturn of 1898. Shit. McCurdy lost his job, and in August 1900, his mother died of a ruptured ulcer. His grandfather died of Bright's disease the following month. Shortly after his grandfather's death, McCurdy left Maine and began drifting around the eastern United States, where he worked as a lead miner and plumber. He was unable to hold a job for an extended period due to his alcoholism. He eventually made his way to Kansas, where he worked as a plumber in Cherryvale. McCurdy, okay, he moved a lot, okay? Public intoxication, blah, blah, blah. In 1907, McCurdy joined the Army. Fort Leavenworth, he was a machine gun operator and trained to use nitroglycerin for demolition purposes. He was honorably discharged. Hey, great. Then he made his way to St. Joseph, Kansas, where he met with an Army friend. He and his friend were arrested for possessing burglary paraphernalia, chisels, hacksaws, funnels for nitroglycerin and gunpowder, and money sacks. I guess money sacks are those sacks with dollar signs on them. That's not a good thing you should have. During their arraignment, McCurdy and his friend told the judge the tools were not intended for burglary, but tools they needed to work on a foot-operated machine gun they were inventing. In January 1911, a jury found McCurdy not guilty, in fact. So then after his release, McCurdy's short-lived career as a bank and train robber began. His robberies were generally bungled affairs due to McCurdy's ineptness. And not real, whoever wrote this is like, fuck this guy. You know, they say like history is written by the victor or whatever. But I do think like, maybe what they mean is, you know, maybe the new version of the best revenge is living well. It's like, no, the best revenge is outliving someone you didn't like and writing their Wikipedia to be accurate, but slightly mean. Because, you know, that'll just stay around. You don't have to make up crazy shit. You don't have to be like, he was a known child molester. You can just be like, well, he was a buffoon and a fool, you know. McCurdy decided to incorporate his training with Nitro into his robberies. This often caused problems as he was overzealous and failed to correctly determine the proper amount to use. He relocated. He tried to rob a train because he heard one of the cars contained a safe with $4,000. They stopped the train and located the safe. McCurdy put the Nitro on the safe's door but used too much. The safe was destroyed in the blast, as was the majority of the money. McCurdy and his partners managed to net $450 in silver coins, most of which were melted and fused to the safe's frame. Okay, I would say it's safe to say that that was quote-unquote bungled. In September 1911, him and two other men robbed the Citizens Bank in Chautauqua, Kansas. After spending 2 hours breaking through the bank wall with a hammer, good God, McCurdy placed a nitro charge around the door of the bank's outer vault. The blast blew the vault door through the bank, destroying the interior, but did not damage the safe inside the vault. McCurdy then tried to blow the safe door open with nitroglycerin, but the charge failed to ignite. After the lookout man got scared and ran off, which I would think because you'd be like, this has got to be loud as shit, McCurdy and his accomplices stole about $150 in coins that were in a tray outside and the safe and fled. Later that night, the men hopped a train, which took them to the Kansas border. They split up and McCurdy made his way to the ranch of a friend, blah, blah, blah. He stayed in the hay shed for a few weeks and drank heavily. Now, this is what I think is interesting is like, I would hate, this is the kind of thing I hate. Like, I imagine being a bank owner, right? And someone's trying to rob the bank. And they don't do it successfully, but they just completely fuck up the bank. They like send the door shooting through the lobby and stuff. And you're just like, come on, guys. Like, you didn't even get anything. You just fucked up the building. You really fucked up my day. And you didn't get anything. McCurdy's final robbery took place on October 4th, 1911, near Okeesa, Oklahoma. McCurdy and two accomplices planned to rob a Katy train after hearing it contained $400,000 in cash. However, McCurdy and the men mistakenly stopped a passenger train instead. The men were able to steal $46 from the mail clerk, two demijohns of whiskey, an automatic revolver, a coat, and the train conductor's watch. So basically, they robbed like one guy. A newspaper account of the robbery later called it one of the smallest in the history of train robbery. McCurdy was disappointed in the haul, he should be, and returned to Rivard's ranch on October 6th, where he began drinking the demijohns of whiskey he stole. By this time, he was also ill with tuberculosis, a mild case of pneumonia, and trichinosis. He stayed up drinking with some of the ranch hands before going to sleep in the hayloft. Unbeknownst to McCurdy, he'd been implicated in the robbery, and a $2,000 reward was issued. A posse of three sheriffs show up, and they traced him there using bloodhounds. And they surrounded the hay shed and waited for daylight. The sheriff recalls, "It began just about 7 o'clock. We were standing around waiting for him to come out when the first shot was fired at me. It missed me, and he then turned his attention to my brother. He shot three times at him, when my brother got under cover, he turned his attention to this other guy. He kept shooting at all of us for about an hour. We fired back every time we could. We do not know who killed him. We found one of the jugs of whiskey, which was taken from the train. It was about empty. He was pretty drunk when he rode up to the ranch last night. So he was killed by a single gunshot wound to the chest." So this is when it gets good, you guys. This section is titled Postmortem Commercialization. McCurdy's body was subsequently taken to the Johnson Funeral Home in Oklahoma, where it was unclaimed. Joseph Johnson, the owner and undertaker, embalmed the body with an arsenic-based preservative, which was typically used in embalming in that era to preserve a body for a long period when no next of kin were known. He then shaved the face, dressed it in a suit, and stored it in the back of a funeral home. As McCurdy lay unclaimed, Johnson refused to bury or release the body until he was paid for his services. Now, see, this is like an interesting funeral home director thing that, like, you could never do this today, right? But basically, you're just like, fuck you. You can't have this body until I pay for it. And I feel like most people would be like, well, what do you, we can just keep it? Well, not Johnson. Johnson decided to exhibit McCurdy to make money. He dressed the corpse in street clothes, placed a rifle in the hands, and stood it up in the corner of the funeral home. For a nickel, Johnson allowed visitors to see the bandit who wouldn't give up. The bandit became a popular attraction at the funeral home and attracted the attention of carnival promoters. Johnson received numerous offers to sell McCurdy's mummified body, but he refused. Now, in another version of this story, by the way, there was like he had it set up in like the basement, and you could see the corpse for a nickel, and you had to put the nickel in the body's mouth. So that was another version of the story. On October 6, 1916, a man calling himself Aver contacted Johnson, claiming to be Elmer McCurdy's long-lost brother from California. Aver had already counted the Osage County, Oklahoma sheriff and a local attorney to get permission to take custody of the body and ship it to San Francisco for proper burial. The following day, Aver arrived at the funeral home with another man calling himself Wayne, who was also claiming to be McCurdy's brother. Johnson released the body to the men, who put it on a train. Whoever wrote this one, it's way too wordy. But it actually was shipped to Arkansas City, Kansas. The men who claimed to be McCurdy's long-lost brothers were, in fact, James and Charles Patterson. James Patterson was a writer of a whole bunch of books. Was the owner of the Great Patterson Carnival Shows, a traveling carnival. After learning from his brother Charles about the popular embalmed bandit exhibit, the two concocted a scheme to take possession of the body in order to feature it in Patterson's carnival. McCurdy's corpse would be featured in Patterson's traveling carnival as the outlaw who would never be captured alive until 1922 when Patterson sold his operation to Louis Sonny. So, let's just get this straight. No one would pay for this corpse. So he's like, all right, fuck it. I'll set it up and I'll just make money off it. Now, he like refuses to sell it because it's making money. And so a couple carnival guys come up with a scheme, which this is the kind of thing you could do in like 1916, right? You could be like, well, I'm his brother. What are they going to do? You show up and you're like, that's him. And then you're willing to pay for him. Like, what can you do? And so now he's been on display in two forms, at a carnival and in a funeral home. Also, this is only a thing I feel like would happen in 1916, where it's like the local funeral home has a quote-unquote attraction there. Louis Sonny used McCurdy's corpse in his traveling Museum of Crime show, which featured wax replicas of famous outlaws like Bill Doolin and Jesse James. In 1928, the corpse was part of the official sideshow that accompanied the Trans-American Foot Race. In 1933, it was acquired for a time by director Dwayne Esper to promote his exploitation film Narcotic. The corpse was placed in the lobby of theaters as a dead dope fiend, whom Esper claimed had killed himself while surrounded by police after he had robbed a drugstore to support his habit. By this time, the skin on McCurdy's body had shriveled and hardened and reduced to the size to that of a child's. Esper pointed out the skin's deterioration as proof of the supposed dope fiend's drug abuse. After Louis Sonny died in 1949, okay, so now we've got funeral home, carnival, and traveling Museum of Crime show, and then also used as a dummy in movie theaters. After Louis Sonny died in 1949, the corpse was placed in storage in an L.A. warehouse. In 1964, Sonny's son Dan lent the corpse to filmmaker David F. Friedman. It eventually made a brief appearance in Friedman's 1967 film She Freak. In 1968, Dan Sonny sold the body along with other wax figures for $10,000 to Spoony Singh, the owner of the Hollywood Wax Museum. Singh had bought the figures for two Canadian men who exhibited them at a show at Mount Rushmore. While being exhibited there, the corpse sustained some damage in a windstorm. The tips of his ears, along with fingers and toes, were blown off. The men eventually returned McCurdy back to Singh, who decided that the corpse looked too gruesome and not lifelike enough to exhibit. Now, okay, this is like 1970, almost. So he died in 1911. So this is 60 years later, and at that point he's like, yeah, this dead corpse is getting a little gross. Singh then sold it to Ed Liersch, part owner of the Pike, an amusement zone in Long Beach, California. By 1976, McCurdy's corpse was hanging in the Laugh in the Dark Funhouse exhibition at the Pike. So then, on December 8, 1976, the production crew of the television show The $6 Million Man were filming scenes for the Carnival of Spies episode at the Pike. During the shoot, a prop man moved what he thought to be a wax mannequin that was hanging from a gallows. When the mannequin's arm broke off, a human bone and muscle tissue were visible. Police were called, and the mummified corpse was taken to the Los Angeles coroner's office. On December 19th, Dr. Joseph Choi conducted an autopsy and determined that the body was that of a human male who had died of a gunshot wound to the chest. The body was completely petrified, covered in wax, and had been covered with layers of phosphorus paint. It weighed approximately 50 pounds and was 63 inches in height. Some hair was still visible on the sides and back of the head, while the ears, big toes, and fingers were missing. The examination also revealed incisions from his original autopsy and embalming. Tests conducted on the tissue showed the presence of arsenic, which was a component of embalming fluid until the late 1920s. Tests also revealed tuberculosis in the lungs, and bunions and scars that McCurdy had. While the bullet that caused the fatal wound was removed, the bullet jacket was found. Blah, blah, blah. These clues helped investigators pinpoint the era in which the man had been killed. Further, the mandible was removed for dental analysis. Inside the mouth was a 1924 penny and ticket stubs to the 140 West Pike Sideshow and Louis Sunny's Museum of Crime. And so someone just crammed that shit in there. Investigators contacted Dan Sunny, who confirmed that the body was Elmer McCurdy. Forensic anthropologist Dr. Dr. Snow, took radiographs, placed them over a photo. He was able to, I mean, how much proof do they need that it was this guy? By December 11th, the story of McCurdy's journey had been featured in newspapers. Several funeral homes called the coroner's office, offering to bury McCurdy free of charge. But officials decided to wait and see if any living relatives would come forward to claim the body. Fred Olds, who represented the Indian Territory Posse of Oklahoma Westerns, eventually convinced Dr. Thomas Noguchi, then the chief medical blah, 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 to allow him to bury the body in Oklahoma. April 22nd, 1977, a funeral procession was conducted to transport McCurdy to the Boot Hill section of Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma. A graveside service attended by approximately 300 people was conducted, after which McCurdy was buried next to another outlaw, Bill Doolin. To ensure that McCurdy's body would not be stolen, 2 feet of concrete was poured over the casket. Now, this is pretty amazing, right? I have to say, what's so interesting about this is to think, like, there was just this corpse in, like, a funhouse at a carnival, and I kind of assume that, like, I have to assume that most of the people there probably didn't actually know that was a fucking dead body, right? Like, they just were like, whatever, it's, like, this scary spook house, and that's how it goes. But it was 66 years after he died that, you know, his body finally was like, all right, we've done what we need to do with this. Let's just put him to rest. And there you go. That's the story of Elmer McCurdy. Oh, it's a good one, huh? I had never heard that one before, but it's pretty fucking awesome. So next time you're going in the scary house, you know, check for mummies. We'll see you at the carnival.